This is a principle that Islam, to a certain extent, has, you know, has affirmed that if we want to give charity, we should start with giving it to our poor relatives, you know. And this is also one of the things that we should take into consideration in this holy month, remembering our relatives who need our help. A lot of times, you know, people are generous and they start, you know, giving charity and their, you know, sadaqah and their zakat or their khums, you know, to people outside of their family, when there are people within their own family who deserve it more than those people. But because of some, you know, family disagreements and arguments, you know, we don't want to give it to them. Oh, I don't like that guy. He said this about me. Let me give it to somebody else. Right? It's easier to give it to somebody we don't know, right? Because we don't really know everything about him, you know, than to give it to somebody we've been living with all our life, right? You know, we know everything about. Right? But here the Imam says, no, give it to the person in your family who deserves it more than those people who are outside of your family. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the people who deserve to be given charity in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Please remember us in your prayers in this holy month of Ramadan. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It was a hugely anticipated ceasefire followed by a truce coming after 7 years of the Saudi onslaught, the truce being 2 months in duration it was supposed to be. It was an opening for a political solution that seemed to have taken place, but Saudi Arabia could not keep its end of the bargain. After not opening Sana'a International Airport based on the ceasefire agreement and allowed to have one flight a week, but then it reneged on that also. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how this may spell the end of the Yemeni truce, and what chances there are for this truce to take shape in order to move into the political process. Well, let's find out more about what has occurred. Abdul Latif Shali is our correspondent who joins us from Yemen's capital, Sana'a. So what is the explanation that's been given at this point for this one flight a week, even for that to not happen?
Thank you so much. The Yemenis, since the beginning of this UN brokered truce, they have been knowing that the Saudi coalition will not commit or obey to the terms of the agreement. They said that the Saudi coalition is maybe trying to rearrange its ranks during this period of time, and they are now trying to just keep detaining the Yemeni fuel ships and also obstructing all the flights were supposed to be coming and getting out of Sana'a Airport. Today, patients were in the airport in the morning and they were surprised that the Saudi coalition stopped this flight also, which is only one flight per week, and it's not even enough to help a few hundreds of people during the truce. Now it has passed almost 3 weeks and the Yemenis did not use the airport. It was supposed to be opened since the first day of the truce, according to the agreement. And unfortunately, Saudi Arabia is only doing everything to undermine the truce. The spokesman of the Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abu Salam, said earlier that the Saudi troops in Marib have conducted a few raids on the city and also have conducted a few military operations against the Yemeni army, but the Yemeni army did not do anything to save the agreement and also to make peace over the country. But unfortunately, the Saudis and all the troops inside the country are trying only to provoke the Yemeni army to launch further operations, whether inside the country or even against Saudi targets. But I believe if they kept just doing this and kept not obeying to the terms of the truce, the Yemeni army will absolutely launch operations, not even not only here and inside the country, but also against maybe Saudi targets, and also Emirati targets will be included in the coming attacks.
Okay, so two key questions before I let you go. First, did they say until further notice? Did they give a date of when the flights would resume? And second key question here, you talked about the reaction by the Yemeni government. They've come out and said they're going to target either UAE or continue with the war. How much time frame did they allow to pass before they started their military operations or restart their military operations?
You know, two fuel ships are still detained by Saudi Arabia. Sana'a Airport is not opened until the moment. 3 weeks have passed until the moment and nothing happened. So the truce is with no benefit for the Yemeni people. Why would the Yemeni people keep telling the Yemeni government, the National Salvation Government, to keep holding this truce? They will absolutely demand the Yemeni army, what they will demand the National Salvation Government to do something to provoke the Saudis or to stop the Saudis from detaining Yemeni oil vessels or opening Sana'a Airport. You know, the last attack against Aramco in Jeddah, that was what Yemenis believe that was the reason behind this truce. And if the Yemeni army have launched further attacks like that one in Jeddah, maybe also inside Emirati territories, this will push the kingdom and also the UAE to stop their war against the Yemeni people and lift the blockade. So now 3 weeks have passed and the truce is only for 2 months. So I don't know, maybe it will be for another week or 2 weeks until the Yemeni army say that the truce is with no benefit for the Yemeni people, and also that the Saudis and the Emiratis did not obey to the terms of the truce.
Thank you very much for that. That's Abdullah Tibal Bouchali, our correspondent there from Sana'a. Okay, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Hamza Karim is a Yemeni writer and activist who joins us from Toronto. Also joining us is Brian Terrell, a political commentator and peace activist who joins us from Molloy, Iowa, I believe.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, great. Welcome to you both. Hamza Karim, let me first start with you. What is going on? You have this indefinite postponement for the flights coming out of Sana'a International Airport, which is the first in 7 years. And you have what was supposed to have been a flight to take, not for recreational use, passengers who needed medical care. So now the permit has been refused to be issued, which is a violation of this two-month truce. Why do you think this has happened?
I truly believe that Saudi Arabia, they don't have serious intentions in committing to any peace, you know, agreements or even this truce that was supposed to last for 2 months. We've seen in the past, for the past 7 years, there have been some truces in place, but really Saudi Arabia wasn't serious about them. Now, what Saudi Arabia is saying is that the main reason that they haven't issued the permit is because, you know, they're asking that all the passports for the passengers should be issued from Aden, which is controlled by them. And then the second issue I think that they're having is that most of the passengers that want to leave Yemen are, you know, the war-wounded survivors. So, again, these are only excuses used by Saudi Arabia to continue blockading Yemen and increasing the suffering of Yemeni people. The truce for the past 3 weeks, we've seen, you know, military actions have been are still taking places in various provinces like Marib, Hajjah, and Saada. There have been over 100 violations since yesterday. The port, the Al-Hudaydah port, is not fully unblockaded. We have two oil ships that are still, you know, held by Saudis at Al-Hudaydah airport or Jizan port. They're held there, and they have over 10,000 tons of oil and gas that is really needed by Yemeni people to resume and live a normal life, needed by hospitals, needed by the cars, needed for transportation, needed by factories. So far, what we've seen is that Saudi Arabia really are not committed to the truce, or are not willing to go further to resume peace talks.
Brian Terrell, something's not making sense here. When you take a look at when the truce was announced, and, you know, it's not a truce that is the first time that was announced. You know, we've had truce announcements before, and we, you know, this was was followed by certain political steps also that we're going to get into in a bit. But we're having on multiple occasions Saudi-led coalition to have broken the truce. The airport, one instance, then you have the, what we understand, positions in Marib of the Yemeni armed forces to have been targeted. You have the, I guess, oil tankers that are being impounded. And it was announced on April the 2nd, and here we are. It's just a little over 3 weeks old. Why do you think Saudi Arabia is committing these violations?
Yeah, it's 3 weeks into this, and you know, we've said it over and over again for so many years that this is a human catastrophe. This is an emergency, and it ought to be dealt with as an emergency. And the food, the situation now in Yemen, with you know, exacerbated by the war in Ukraine, which provides 40% of Yemeni wheat, and now the food prices, just since this war started, has gone up 150% in Yemen, where most people can't afford the food and couldn't afford the food to begin with. So no, there's not goodwill here, and there's not goodwill on the part of the United States either. You know, President Biden, as a candidate, parroted what everybody else is saying about the disaster of the war in Yemen and how barbaric it is and how it has to stop, and pledged U.S. cooperation with the Saudi effort would end. And in the first year of the Biden presidency, more than $1 billion worth of missiles sold to the Saudis. We're also seeing, I'm really happy to see that there's now a new effort by some people in the U.S. Congress to make a War Powers Resolution Act to stop the United States from cooperating with the Saudis. And this is something that the Democrats have done before. When Trump was president, and knowing that Trump would veto such a bill, and he did when it was passed. And now the Democrats largely are not behind this, and I think it's because it will force Biden into a situation where he'd have to either pass or veto such a bill. So yeah, and what's happening at the airport is like the idea that because some of the passengers don't carry passports from the Aden government, which in almost any way you want to look at it, doesn't exist anymore. You know, right after early this month, the President Hadi was dismissed or stepped down, replaced by a presidential leadership council. It's a government that doesn't really exist, and any kind of negotiations, you know, with Yemen has to include the government that is actually in power, whether people like it or not. the Nasra government is the government of Yemen, and there can't be any resolution without recognizing that and recognizing their passports, being able to talk at high levels with them. It's absurd to think that any steps forward can be made without that.
All right. Well, let's since you mentioned the U.S. and at the end there you're talking about that presidential council. Let's talk about the U.S. If we can, Hamza Karim. I'm looking at the statement made very recently by the U.S. President Joe Biden on this, of which he has said that he has welcomed the agreement, but he said the terms of the ceasefire was just the first step. Again, I'm looking to see where this went wrong. Do you think that there was any kind of pushback by the U.S., change of mind by the U.S., then relate to Saudi Arabia? Because we know that the U.S. is trying to, one way or another, whether Joe Biden likes it or not, trying to claw its way back into the Saudis' liking, based on some reports. Do you think maybe the U.S. instigated a change of mind on the part of Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely. I think, Saudi Arabia in this war, they haven't been really driving or leading this war. We all know that Saudi Arabia can't make any moves, especially like these big moves, without a green light from the U.S. administration. Now, if we all remember, this truce came after the attack that happened in Aramco in Jeddah, and we all know that back then and even now, U.S. cannot stand seeing the gas prices going up and do nothing about it. The war in Ukraine right now is already driving the prices of gas up, and they can't take seeing the prices going even more. So I think there was some pressure on Saudi Arabia to really at least absorb some of the anger that is happening in the international community and inside Yemen because of this war, really rearrange themselves in Yemen and trying to get all the groups that are fighting for Saudi Arabia and UAE and U.S. together and really get their ducks in a row to go back to this war again. For me, I don't see U.S. really being very serious about stopping this war in Yemen. If they were very serious about it, they would have, stopped selling arms to Saudi Arabia. They would have really just stopped providing them with all the intelligence and the logistics to continue this war. But so far, we haven't seen any serious steps or taking place by the U.S. So definitely, U.S. is not happy and are not willing to really stop this war. We haven't seen any serious actions. So I definitely agree that since the beginning of this truce, Saudi Arabia and U.S. weren't serious. They were just trying to buy some time to get their ducks in a row, to rearrange themselves, and to go back into this war.
Okay, well, let's go through the motions here as to where this stood in terms of the presidential council, or excuse me, Presidential Leadership Council, Brian Terrell. On April 7th, this was sworn in before the parliament in Aden. Okay, and there they announced that they were going to negotiate with the Ansarullah movement for a permanent ceasefire, which then we were looking at the two-month ceasefire that came into, or truce, that was announced. And then we went through that show about Hadi transferring powers to the council. Of course, many are deducting that the Saudi Crown Prince fired him pretty much. But then we're looking at the representation of power, where there's an equal distribution of power between the countries north and south. And then you have the council, which includes the prominent leader of the SDC, the Southern Transitional Council, supported by Saudi Arabia and also as coalition part of the UAE. I went through this in order to ask you whether there was a change of heart or something that did not now stand well with Saudi Arabia in terms of the composition of the leadership council or the way that this went down. What do you think?
No, I really don't know about that. I think what's interesting is the Hadi government was the reason that the justification that the Saudi Arabia gave to begin with to be in Yemen at all in the first place. So with that gone, it kind of takes the chair out from under the Saudis and their excuse. I think that there is a there is a fear that the Saudis have and the United States has that peace might break out, and if this Presidential Leadership Council shows any promise of really negotiating, with the Houthi government and really coming to an end to this this war and this horrible starvation, that will be stopped. That will not be tolerated by the Saudis or the United States. This is a cash cow, and the rising of the gas prices, as our friend said, is a very big issue here. While the gas prices are going up, the profits for the oil companies are going up too. So the anger needs to be assuaged, but we don't want to start bringing the prices down either. The planet is in really bad shape, and we're in danger of catastrophic climate change. And all this time, all these these months that should be used, the research, the resources that should be put into finding alternatives to fossil fuels, instead are going toward this war. And we're seeing in the United States the Biden administration is not only allowing for more permits to drill and to frack, to use U.S. Oil and gas to counteract what's being boycotted from with the Russians.
Right.
We're putting everything as being set back, and the world is being put. We need to do something very, very different.
Sure.
We need to do it quick. The people of Yemen are suffering, and they're dying now. And mass starvation is real. But the whole planet needs the Saudis and the United States and everybody, the Russians, to change its course.
Sure. Well, this Presidential Leadership Council, Hamza Karim, I'm curious as to whether this was going to work anyways. Because if you want to take a look at the way that the leadership was going to be, it was very murky as to what type of influence could the Saudi side have, when we know on the ground it is the Ansarullah currently and the Yemeni government who have the support from the people. I mean, who does Saudi Arabia have or can put in place there for any type of reconciliation to happen? That's always been a big question mark.
Yeah, just to give you a bit of background about this Presidential Leadership Council. So what Saudi Arabia did alongside with UAE, and backed by the U.S., of course, is trying to group all the groups in ground in Yemen that had problems and even fought and killed each other in the past. There are some groups who are aligned with the UAE. Some of them are aligned with Saudi Arabia. So what they tried to do is put all these groups together. Now, these groups, the members of these groups, they all have power in ground, except for the president of the Presidential Leadership Council. But so what they're trying to do is basically get all these groups together and make them sit down and really work as a team. But we've seen this for the past 7 years. This did not work. These groups, they fought with each other. They killed each other in Aden, in Marib, in Shabwa, in many provinces. But I think there is some kind of pressure now on them to come together and work under one leadership. But I don't think this is going to work because all these groups have their own agendas. They all have their own plans. They want to they want to control some certain areas in Yemen. And it's very hard to bring them all together under one umbrella and put to a one leadership for them all. So in my opinion, I don't see this is working because, they all have different agendas. They all have different objectives. They all have different visions. And it's very hard to put them all together in one table.
Well, then what are we looking at, Brian Terrell, if this thing falls apart, which is unfortunately going in that direction? What type of direction is this thing going to go, which we're looking at the threat that the Ansarullah movement and the Yemeni government has made, is that they're going to again go through targeting Saudi Arabia and the UAE?
Yeah, it doesn't look good in this council by the very fact that it was pretty much appointed and put in place by the Saudis means it's going to fail Nothing, the Saudis do not hold the key to solving the problems of Yemen, and neither does the United States. I hate to see it. It looks, as our friend says, it seems inevitable that the Saudi military is going to react as militaries do and as governments do, and under the provocations that it's facing. And it's not going to go well for the people of Yemen either. Because the Saudi, the UAE, and the United States, and our different allies are definitely stronger than the Yemenis have proven themselves very bravely and very and used a lot of ingenuity with its limited weaponry, but in the end, by sheer firepower, this is not going to be a military solution. It's not going to be a military solution that's imposed by the United States or Saudi Arabia, and it's not going to be a military solution that comes out of the Ansarullah government either. The promise that this showed of a negotiated end to the war is, as it falls apart, is all the more bitter, because in the end, that's the only thing that's going to happen. Someday it's going to happen. And how many people are going to have to die before then? Because there isn't any solution. Nothing will happen unless there's really good faith efforts for all parties to sit down and negotiate an end. And we have not seen any goodwill on the part of the Saudi Arabia or U.S., the UAE, the other coalition partners. It doesn't look good for the near future. We have to, our hope has to be a little farther out, and our prayers are with the people of Yemen. And as an American, my apologies are just so heartfelt, and I feel so bad about what our government's been doing to the people of Yemen and people all over the world.
All right, we're going to end it there. We are fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist. Hamza Karim, thank you, Yemeni writer and activist. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَلَوْ شِئْنَا لَبَعَثْنَا فِي كُلِّ قَرْيَةٍ نَذِيرًا.
And if we had willed, we could have sent into every city a warner.
Brothers and sisters, we are now going to talk about the 51st verse of this chapter. وَلَوْ شِئْنَا لَبَعَثْنَا فِي كُلِّ قَرْيَةٍ نَذِيرًا. And if we had pleased, certainly we would have raised up a warner in every town. Dear listeners, this verse is somehow talking about the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam as the last and the seal of the prophets, and it also talks about the comprehensiveness of the religion of the Prophet of Islam, because this verse is implying that no prophet was appointed anywhere with him, since he can control the entire society, since he is able to control everyone, and no one else is needed. He has such a rank, he has such a state, that prophethood is closed with his existence. So this is what we can infer first and foremost from this verse. It is also possible that some polytheists used this pretext, along with other ones, that it was better that Allah appointed a prophet in every village and city. But in answer to them, the Holy Quran says, وَلَوْ شِئْنَا لَبَعَثْنَا فِي كُلِّ قَرْيَةٍ نَذِيرًا. If we had pleased, we would have raised up a warner in every town, certainly. So, this verse is a reason for magnificence of the Prophet's rank. This verse is showing the necessity of the unity of leadership. This verse can help us understand the heaviness of the duty of leadership of one society, that it has to be comprehensive, and it is a very heavy responsibility.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine.
In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Now, there is also a lot of discussions about how one should rule a society and how we should decide upon the rulers. But the point that is taken for granted in every society is that we need a leader for everyone. We need a leader for every nation and society. The Holy Quran says,
وَإِنْ مِنْ أُمَّةٍ إِلَّا خَلَى فِيهَا نَذِيرٌ. There did not exist one society or ummah without a warner between them. But this does not necessarily mean that we need to have one separate ruler or, in this case, prophet in every society and nation, because this would hurt the comprehensiveness. This would hurt the state and rank of the prophet, of the one who wants to be the ruler of the whole society. So that is why the Holy Quran says, وَلَوْ شِئْنَا لَبَعَثْنَا فِي كُلِّ قَرْيَةٍ نَذِيرًا. If we could, we would. We could have done this to raise up a warner in everywhere. But of course, this would ease your responsibility. This would help you from some aspects, but this does not necessarily mean that we should practically do it in the world, because this would bring so many other challenges and problems. So, this being said, we understood that we need a ruler and a leader for every society, but we do not need to have separate leaders. The last point regarding this verse, brothers and sisters, is the fact that prophethood and leadership of the nations and ummah in the Islamic world specifically is something that only can be decided by the words of the Almighty Allah and no one else. This is not something that the people can start to make, or they can start to choose from among themselves. This is what the words of this verse are explicitly telling us. وَلَوْ شِئْنَا لَبَعَثْنَا. These pronouns in the verbs شِئْنَا and لَبَعَثْنَا are translated into us. If we wanted, if we had pleased, we would have raised up a warner. This means it only relies on the hands of the Almighty Allah and no one else. It is only His right to choose. And we as the believers, actually we do not have the abilities, we do not have that much intellect to set a leader from among ourselves for such a crucial matter. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode of the program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Recent deadly attacks in Afghanistan have left Afghan families grieving. Some have lost their parents, and some their children. Here, we are meeting the family of Shahid Milad, who was killed in Tuesday's school bombing in Kabul. Milad's mother can't speak, as she is in a flood of tears, mourning the loss of her young son. But his disabled father managed to speak with great sorrow.
Milad was a very diligent boy. It was his last year at school. He was preparing himself to enter university. He used to tell me that he was going to become a doctor and make a living so that his father doesn't have to work. He wished to serve his family and society, but unfortunately they took him from us.
In another alley in Hazara neighborhood, another family is mourning the death of a father. After the attack on school students, Mir Hussain went to bring his son home. But he himself fell victim to the second explosion.
My brother was on the roof when he heard a bomb explosion at the school. He quickly went to school to find his son Mahdi. He was searching around when the second explosion occurred. He was injured in the attack, but later at the hospital, we lost him forever.
Mahdi has survived the attack, but he is struggling with the shock of the attack and the pain of losing his father. Likewise, in the west of Kabul, there are many families whose beloved ones are either killed or wounded. They feel despaired and can't hold back their tears. It remains to be seen if the time can heal their wounds. These days, Afghan families want peace and security. People here say they're terrified of repeated blind terror attacks. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A big rally was held in the besieged Gaza Strip to support Al-Quds in the face of rising Israeli aggression against the Holy City. Thousands of people from all walks of life came out to express their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli attacks. Tensions have been on the rise in recent days as extremist Israeli settlers, backed by Israeli regime forces, desecrated the city's Al-Aqsa Mosque. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and slammed the silence of Arab countries towards the Israeli crimes. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the Friday rally, warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
We will not leave Al-Quds as a prey for the Zionist enemy, and our people are united today in defending Al-Quds. The Palestinian resistance is very strong and will defend Al-Quds against Zionist attacks. Today's rally and the masses here are sending a strong message to the Zionist enemy. If these Zionist attacks against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque don't come to an end, our people will explode in the face of the Zionist entity.
Since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, the Israeli forces and illegal settlers have been trying to prevent Palestinians from gathering and performing their religious duties at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state.
We are here today to show our solidarity and support for Al-Quds in the face of Zionist aggressions. All Palestinian resistance groups are here to send a message of unity. We will spare no effort to protect Al-Quds, and we call on all Arabs and Muslims to support the resistance and help us to protect Al-Quds and the Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians have expressed their willingness to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Islam's holy book, the Quran, is the theme of this expo. Held every year in the fasting month of Ramadan, the International Quran Exhibition opened its doors after 2 years of hiatus, driven by the coronavirus pandemic. Now, the 29th edition of the event has brought here exhibitors from Iran and other Muslim countries to present their religious products. While the expo displays exquisite copies of the Quran, it also gives a chance to IT firms to showcase online versions of the Holy Book, among other religious apps and software. The art section is one of the popular parts of the event. It features paintings, calligraphy works, and conceptual artworks, all themed with the Quran. The holy month of Ramadan is believed to be the month when the holy book of Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad some 14 centuries ago. That's why this exhibition is held during the holy month, which is also referred to as the month of Quran.
Every Muslim family has a copy of the Quran in their houses to read its verses and ponder its divine messages as many times as possible during the year, and especially in Ramadan, as the month of the Quran's revelation to the Prophet. Now, one of the major goals of this expo is to promote the instructions of the Divine Book, especially among the younger generation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Braving the scorching heat while fasting, protesters took to the streets after Friday prayers across Pakistan to voice solidarity with Palestinians as tension continued to simmer in the occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli forces once again attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Protesters here are outraged over what they call the double standards of the international community and the way they view Ukraine compared to Palestine.
Double standards is the biggest issue with international community. East Timor, South Sudan, Kashmir, Palestine, you name it. When Muslims are victims, they will always turn their backs on us. Therefore, I think it's about time to put an end to this collective behavior against Muslims on international stage.
Actually, we are being a Muslim, Al-Aqsa, the Muslims over there are brothers and sisters. If they're in pain, we are feeling the same pain in our body. The whole Muslim Ummah is like a one body. If one part feels is in pain, the whole body feels the pain. So we are feeling that pain, and we are gathered here to tell the world that they are not alone. We are with them.
Speakers at the rally stressed upon the need of unity among the Muslim world.
We are who are gathered over here because of, as you know, the situation which is going on in Palestine. Israelis are continuously terrorizing or they are attacking the innocent people of Palestine. That's why we are gathering in the protest to show their solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Again, you know, the Jews, army and the military, paramilitary forces, they are not letting the Muslims over there freely praying and offering their rituals of the Ramadan. And everybody knows this is the holiest month of Ramadan, and this is very sacred to the Muslim.
The Israeli aggression against Palestinians has once again escalated during the fasting month of Ramadan. Scores of Palestinians have been injured by the Israeli forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque over the past few days. Mohammed Touri, Karachi.
Amid ongoing violence in Palestine, hundreds of London protesters mobbed outside Israel's embassy to condemn the regime's ongoing onslaught. The Islamic holy site in the occupied capital, Jerusalem Al-Quds, has been targeted with daily raids by not just regime forces, but also Zionist fanatics who seek to desecrate Islam's second holiest site during Ramadan, the holiest month for Muslims.
I struggle to comprehend how human beings can do this to others. You know, It's occupation, but for the numbers of people that are happy to use their hate to hit and kill people, the anger that I feel and the sadness and the heartache for the Palestinians, it's difficult.
The unrest also sparked hostilities between Gaza-based Palestinian resistance fighters and Israeli regime forces as the two sides exchanged fire early on Thursday. The lack of mainstream media attention, despite the shocking footage which has emerged, has equally infuriated many onlookers.
It's not just me. Every Palestinian have been hit with the fact that international law is very selective. The application of international law depends on the interests of these countries. And, you know, the major powers insist to keep putting Israel above the law, to keep shielding Israel from international scrutiny and international sanctions. And if this does anything, it actually exposes that the world is not serious about its own rules and laws.
This isn't the first time that the Israeli regime has conducted acts of aggression against Muslims during the holy month of Ramadan in occupied Palestine. However, global awareness of Israel's crimes is at an all-time high, and with future protest action planned over the next days and weeks here in London, the global reaction to what's been going on is far from over. Robert Carter, London.
Whispers with God on a night that's believed by Muslims to be a time when their wishes are fulfilled. It's called Laylatul Qadr, or the Night of Destiny. Muslims observe the occasion every year in the month of Ramadan, when they congregate at religious sites to pray and make wishes. To Iranians, no place is better than the shrine of the 8th Shia Imam Reza in the city of Mashhad to keep vigil on the occasion.
Words cannot describe my feelings tonight. It's a night of destiny when God has promised to listen to our prayers. It's a night which the Quran says is better than 1,000 months. I'm so happy to be in Imam Reza's shrine on this divine night.
After 2 years, we once again can visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, our beloved Imam, and that on the night of destiny. I wish that God will eradicate the coronavirus once and for all, for us to be able to live peacefully and visit our holy sites.
Islamic scriptures say Laylatul Qadr marks the night when the Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad. The Quran says on this night, angels descend on earth to listen to the prayers of worshippers.
We believe that on the night of destiny, angels come to earth upon God's order. The Quran says in its verses that the book was revealed to the Prophet on this night, and the angels will stay on earth till dawn. That's why we never miss out on this holy night and come here to pray.
No exact date is provided for the Night of Destiny, but all Islamic references are unanimous that the Quran was revealed to the Prophet on one of three different dates, the 19th, the 21st, or the 23rd night of the holy month of Ramadan.
It's the first time after more than 2 years that the Night of Destiny is marked without serious concerns over the coronavirus. And this has attracted this huge number of pilgrims to the shrine of Imam Reza to once again mark Laylatul Qadr en masse and at the same time reunite with their 8th Imam after 2 years. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
Violence, oppression, and desecration of holy sites. Just more of the Ramadan reminders that Palestinians continue to live under occupation and suffer daily injustices. More than ever, international solidarity, especially in an age of social media, is important. With the atrocities being committed against Palestinians, raising awareness and exhibiting support is more crucial than before. This year's Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is giving millions across the world the opportunity to show solidarity by displaying a Palestinian flag in person or online.
If we are not able to stand up at this hour of need and be supportive to those Palestinians by holding a flag on our car, on our shops, on our homes, then what are we good for? And when are we going to do this? And I think really what I have seen ordinary people responding so fantastically.
In the lead-up to the annual Al-Quds rally in the British capital, the global support for the campaign is in full swing.
Organizers are encouraging participation in this year's event, and taking part could not be more simple. First of all, please post your image or your footage online, encourage a few friends to do the same, and of course, use the hashtag.
As the global solidarity movement grows, so does the opposition. A fact not lost on pro-Palestine campaigners.
We got ministers coming and saying, you know, they're going to refer us to the police for saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. It's outrageous. These are the same people that actually articulate that freedom of speech is absolute. And, you know, they go on and on. What's wrong with any part of the world to be free? What's wrong with asking people to be free?
So organizers are urging you to do your part. Lift your voice in solidarity and fly the flag for Palestine. Amina Taylor, London.
Yemen Civil Aviation and Meteorology Authority announced that the first commercial flight to Sana'a International Airport will start next Sunday from Anto, Jordan. Observers say the UN brokered agreement said there will be two flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan, and allowing one flight only is not enough to help the humanitarian situation.
Announcing the start of one flight per week to Jordan is not enough and confirms there are no sincere intentions by the Saudi-led coalition to abide by the declared UN truce. There must be a full opening of Sana'a Airport and the port of Hodeidah because the humanitarian situation cannot tolerate more restrictions.
The Ministry of Health says thousands of patients, including children, are in dire need to travel abroad for treatment. Therefore, the United Nations should fulfill its duty and remove any restrictions on the two weekly flights.
Yemeni patients suffer greatly due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport because they need to travel abroad for treatment. There are 30,000 registered patients in the higher medical committee, including children suffering from congenital anomalies and cancer. We demand the United Nations and the UN envoy open Sana'a's airport permanently and not for one or two flights per week, as it's not enough to help the humanitarian situation.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015 and imposed a closure on Sana'a International Airport. This closure has led to the death of thousands of patients, including children, especially amid the collapse of the healthcare system in the country due to the years-long Saudi war and the blockade.
Yemenis received the news of resuming the flights of Sana'a International Airport with hopes to see further flights to other destinations around the world. They say opening Sana'a Airport will save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, who are in danger amid the absence of essential healthcare services. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For the first time since the onset of the COVID pandemic, hundreds of people of faith and none gathered in the shadow of North London's Finsbury Park Mosque to enjoy a breaking of the fast in a public setting. The iftar, backed by the local council and organized by Finsbury Park Mosque, Muslim Welfare House and British Muslim charity Islamic Relief, was an opportunity for the community to gather, celebrate and reflect.
It's good to show solidarity, Muslim, non-Muslim, Jews, Christian, all coming together to share a meal. This is a very powerful message that we are united, we are all at one despite our differences.
It's important because it's a very visible sign of the friendship and, you know, the togetherness that we have all through the year, actually. But and it's such lovely hospitality.
For me, it's an opportunity to, I suppose, show solidarity with my Muslim sisters and also, as Pauline said, to take part in this wonderful experience.
It's no coincidence that